We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That statement in the Declaration of Independence has been called the single greatest and most important sentence ever written in the English language. But did Thomas Jefferson believe it when he wrote it? Did most Americans believe it when they read it? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Over the last 200 years or so, many Americans have taken issue with that phrase, all men are created equal, since it was written by a man who owned slaves. Given that clarion call for liberty and equality, what did the men who would create the American nation have in mind for slavery before the Revolution broke out? How viable was slavery in the years leading up to the Revolution, and how much agitation for the abolition of it was there in the North and South? Our guest is John Kaminsky, director of the Center for the Study of the American Constitution in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Good to be here.
It does seem like the central irony, doesn't it, of America, the idea that you have this Declaration of Independence, of human equality, of liberty, written and signed by men who own slaves.
Yes, it is inconsistent, and they readily saw that it was inconsistent. And when Jefferson wrote those wonderful words, I don't believe that he really felt that he was stating what was the reality, that there was a difference between men of different races. There was a difference between men of the same race. There was a difference between men and women. And so he was talking more in theoretical and philosophical terms when he wrote what he wrote. And so I don't think he saw that there was a major contradiction. There was a problem with American society, and that had to be corrected, and that would take a while, and they would work at it. Some would work harder than others. Some would want to free their slaves very quickly. Others had no desire at all to free their slaves. But I think it's an interesting perception here to look at what Americans thought in 1763, at the end of the French and Indian War. It was at that time that there was a real movement to eliminate, first of all, the slave trade, which was such an inhumane conveyance of free men, women, and children out of Africa in horrendous conditions on board pestilential ships, and many of them would die on the way. And putting them into permanent slavery. And so there was a movement afoot, mainly by Quakers and Baptists, to eliminate the foreign slave trade. And then the hope would be to eliminate slavery itself. And I think if you look at that year, 1763, there was a far greater chance that slavery and the slave trade would be eliminated than that America would be independent of Great Britain. No Americans at that time really wanted independence from Great Britain. They wanted to stay in the British Empire. They were proud to be British.
Well, they just survived a war against the French and Indians, largely with the help of the British Army.
Right, and the Spanish also were the opponents. And so at the end of that war, Canada was now part of the British Empire. Florida was part of the Empire, Cuba. And so it looked as if the Americans had a future of peace without worry from enemies surrounding them. And the whole British policy changed, however, and caused an increasing desire for independence from Great Britain. But as I said, at that particular time, there was a greater propensity to free the slaves than to free Americans from British rule.
And how widespread was slavery at that time? Let's say you take 1763, who owned slaves, and to what extent was the economy dependent on them?
Well, I think the standard interpretation of that holds true. In 1776, which I'm more familiar with than 1763, there were 3 million Americans. And of that 3 million Americans, about 600,000 were African-American slaves. And of that remaining, about 2.5 million white folks that were here, only about 500,000 were white adult men. And so American society was largely women and children. And then you had about the same number of African slaves as you had adult white men, probably about 100,000 more African slaves. All of the colonies, all of the states had slaves. There was no free North and slave South. The Southern colonies, the Southern states then, obviously had more slaves than the Northern. But this was not always true. New York had almost as many slaves as Georgia. It was held in a different kind of bondage. Most of the slaves in New York were held by individual farmers, would have one or two slaves in the Hudson River Valley. And then you would have domestic slaves in the two cities of Albany and New York. You didn't have a plantation system where you had lots of slaves in the North. You did have a plantation system of sorts in Rhode Island because leftover slaves were brought back to Rhode Island. It was the Rhode Islanders in Massachusetts, slavers, that brought slaves over. These New England states were the primary individuals involved in the slave trade themselves. And they would first drop off slaves in the West Indies, and then they go to the Southern states, and the slaves that were left were brought back to their home states. And so Rhode Island had quite a few slaves, and most of them were in the plantation economy and in the cities of Newport and Providence. In the South, slavery was, as we might look at it, the Chesapeake area had tobacco, and the Deep South, Georgia and South Carolina in particular, had rice and indigo. But often there was an overabundance of slaves, and they were often then rented out, sometimes for an extended period of time, for a year, other times only for a job. A house needed to be built or a barn needed to be built in. A planter with excess slaves would rent out their slave. You have to be a little cautious about doing that because slaves, as any other capital equipment that a slave owner would have, you guarded that and you didn't want it damaged. And so you were a little reluctant to rent out your slave for a long time because the person doing the renting didn't have that investment, that long-term investment, and might work your slave too hard.
What kind of agitation was there in England in 1763 to abolish slavery? I would assume that the real drive at that point, since we're talking about English citizens in 1763, would have come from England.
There's relatively little movement to eliminate slavery in England. There are very few slaves that are in England. It's not until a little bit later, the next decade in the 1770s, 1772, you get the Somerset case, which was very important. Lord Mansfield ruled that Somerset, that was the name of a slave, James Somerset, he was told by his master he was going back to the West Indies, and he didn't want to go back. And so his master forcibly took him aboard the ship that was going to leave, and Somerset's friends got a writ of habeas corpus to bring him off the ship and before the courts. And it was ruled that no person could be forced to leave against his wish. And in essence, that case really meant no slavery in Great Britain.
The implications of that are enormous.
Yes, and Americans knew about that. And in America, when you have the revolution taking place, you have state constitutions that are being written, and those state constitutions often have bills of rights attached to them, and bills of rights start out almost always, all men are created equal. And when this was brought before the court in Massachusetts in the Quogue Walker case in 1781, Walker ran away from his master, and his master found where he was and tried to get him to come back. Walker would not agree, so his master beat him up. Nathaniel Jennison, the name of the master, was charged with battery. And this was tried before the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, and William Cushing, the Chief Justice, through the stroke of his pen, said that he interpreted the Massachusetts Declaration of Rights, all men created equal, that slavery never legally existed in Massachusetts, and that Jennison was guilty of battery, and Walker was free. So with the stroke of his pen, he emancipated all the slaves. It took 3 years for that message to get through the state of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. But in the census of 1790, the federal census of 1790, we see that there are no slaves in Massachusetts. So it's the only state that does not have slaves at the time that the Constitution is adopted.
Well, I was wondering, because you're saying that there was more likelihood, it seemed, that America would free the slaves than that it would declare its independence from Great Britain in these early years. What would be the motives for getting rid of slavery then? I mean, was there a growing moral outrage that there was something wrong about it, or what would have motivated these?
Oh, absolutely. It was a moral imperative, no question about that, because slavery was fairly profitable at this time. when the colony of Georgia went through its formative stage. It was a trustee colony for the first 25 years and composed of many debtors and prisoners who had been sent over, and there was no slavery. But at the end of that 25-year period, it became a royal colony, and it had to decide, do we want to have slavery or not? Well, the two northern neighbors were flourishing with slavery, and so they decided that, yes, they would have slavery. One planter, his name was Blackland McIntosh, his father was in that group that decided for slavery, even though he didn't like slavery per se, but he bought slaves. And when his father died, Blackland inherited those slaves. And as the war came, 1774, 1775, it was McIntosh who led a petition drive in the surrounding counties that he lived in to free the slaves immediately. There should be no hesitation. We should free them because of the rhetoric that was there. The rhetoric was growing in America for liberty. Slaves understood this. Slaves were waiting on their masters around the dinner table when these issues were being discussed, and they understood that their freedom was at stake also. And so McIntosh is sort of an example of all Americans in doing this. But later on, he changes. Later on, when the Constitution is being considered, he sees the need to import slaves for the expanding economy of Georgia and to replace all those slaves who had left Georgia, either taken away by the British when they evacuated Savannah, or who left on their own and either joined the British or escaped to the West or escaped to Florida.
What were the thoughts regarding what those free slaves were going to do once they were freed? Integrate into the socioeconomic system, remain apart somehow, emigrate?
It was uncertain what they might do, and in fact, obviously those people who didn't want slaves to be freed or who kept their slaves were quite apprehensive of keeping freedmen near their slaves and how they might infect the slaves with the desire for independence and freedom. And so in some places it was required that they would leave the colony or the state and go elsewhere. That was the case in Virginia. In Virginia, was very difficult, almost impossible, to free your slaves. By a law passed in the 1720s, the only way to free a slave was to go before the legislature and get a specific bill for the emancipation of that individual.
Yes.
But in 1782, things changed. And because, again, the rhetoric that was there, you could free your slave in your lifetime by manumission, or you could free your slave in your will. And the slave did not have to leave the state. And in fact, by 1810, there were probably over 60,000 freedmen in both Virginia and Maryland. So there were a lot of freedmen, and they did the usual kinds of things that anybody would do. They'd be hired out as apprentices, and then they'd be masters at their craft, whether it be a blacksmith or a cooper or a shoemaker. They did everything as well as continuing to work in agriculture.
How much did the occasional slave rebellion, especially in the Caribbean, affect the thinking in America on the brink of the revolution?
Well, there are slave revolutions in the Caribbean occur a little bit later, not right then, but there's always a fear of a slave rebellion at any level. That is, it could be just one individual committing an act, whether that be putting glass in the food of the master, or whether it be stealing or something of that sort, or whether there be conspiracy. And so there's no doubt that one of the arguments for eliminating the slave trade was to inhibit the increasing danger of slave uprisings. They didn't have the term a fifth column. That didn't start until the Spanish Civil War, but they felt that there was a fifth column there with slaves, and they greatly hated what Lord Dunmore did in Virginia. In November 1774, he issued a proclamation that any slave who would walk away from his or her master, kill them if that be necessary, and join the British would be free. And this was a despicable act on the part of the British to invoke slave uprisings, which was a very, very fearsome thing.
2 years
among
before
Americans.
The revolution.
Yes, yes.
And
2 years before independence was declared. I mean, the revolutionary movement is going on. And remember, April 19th, 1775 is the shot heard around the world. So there's conflict going on.
Close.
Some of the key figures in that revolution, like George Washington or like Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine, and so on, where did they stand on the issue of slavery at this point in the mid-1770s?
Thomas Jefferson, as a young man, introduced motions in the Virginia legislature to prohibit the foreign slave trade. There were a lot of individuals who fell into that camp and would go so far. He also sounded out the legislature on emancipation, and he saw right away that there was absolutely no desire for that in Virginia and never again would bring that forth. He did bring forth statements and proposals for the elimination of the slave trade, and that was, in fact, part of the Declaration of Independence. A man like Thomas Paine, he came to America in November of 1774 and landed in Philadelphia. He was never a Pennsylvanian. He was always an American, an American perspective about him. And he wrote pieces in the Pennsylvania Magazine, which is where he was employed as the editor of that magazine. And he was writing about 40% of the copy for that magazine. And by writing these anti-slavery articles, he endeared himself with the abolitionist movement in Pennsylvania, men like Benjamin Rush. And it got him the attention that was important because more and more Paine started writing on the revolutionary movement. And Rush was the one who told him to abandon writing newspaper articles, put it in a pamphlet, and don't use the pseudonym Plain Truth. How about Common Sense? And so Rush was very important to him, and it was a connection with the anti-slavery voice of Paine that got that relationship with Benjamin Rush.
Are we aware at all of any slaves who took the British up on their offer of slaying their masters and going over to the British line? And then the flip side of that would be, what kind of American offers were there to slaves as the revolution breaks out?
Well, I'm not aware of anybody being killed by their slaves. Certainly many of them ran away, and many of them joined the British. Their lot was not very happy. At the end of the war, they were taken away against a provision of the peace treaty. From New York City, many more slaves were taken than should have been taken, and the British had a seemingly philanthropic attitude toward them. But more often than not, the slaves were sent to the West Indies, continued to be slaves. They were slaves of the officers. Occasionally, they were brought back to England, but a lot of them went to Canada, to Halifax, and did not fare well there. In 1781, in the Battle of Yorktown, it was Cornwallis who sent infected slaves, slaves with smallpox, out to the Americans to give up the slaves to the Americans in the hope of infecting the Americans with smallpox. And so they were used in a sort of germ warfare. So the slaves did not fare real well with the British, I would say. On the American side, many slaves chose to join and fight with the Americans. And I would say anywhere from a quarter to a third of the American Navy was made up of African Americans. And a very substantial number of enlistees in the Army were African Americans.
And what about the discussions of giving arms to slaves?
That was a highly suspect. You can imagine you have this paranoia of slave uprisings. You don't want to give the revolters the means and the knowledge of how to use these arms, because they might use them against your own people, and not only your own people, but when your menfolk are gone and they're off either fighting or off in Congress and their families are left alone, their wives and their children. And so it's very fearful. There's only a relatively small number of Americans who really pushed the idea of arming the slaves. And they did it for a couple of reasons. A man like John Lawrence, who most Americans don't know who John Lawrence was, and that's because it was one of the tragedies of the war. At the end of the war, he was killed in a skirmish. But he would be the equivalent, the Southern equivalent, of Alexander Hamilton. His father was president of Congress for 2 years, Henry Lawrence. And so John Lawrence had great promise, and he was an advocate for emancipation. He wanted to free the slaves. He wanted to arm the slaves. So what he might have done in South Carolina, who knows, if he had lived. But he was an advocate. Other advocates, Jonathan Dickinson Sargent, advocating arming the slaves and sending them up to Canada to fight in Canada. The Americans had been unsuccessful in Canada in 1775, almost won. But winter came and smallpox came, and they were defeated. send the slaves there. That would serve a couple purposes. It would get rid of them from the American scene where they were a danger. It would create a second front where the British would have to keep men there to fight the slaves. And if the slaves would be successful, as there was reason to believe they would be, then it would be a place that we could settle the blacks when they were freed. Those people who felt that we could not live together. There would be a vast continent. The continent was large enough two races to live together. And when they did that, they would be given land there, and they could pay off their former masters with the profits that they got
sounds
from
idyllic.
Their lands. So it seemed like a win-win proposition.
But you can hear the sort of mixture of things in Jonathan Dickinson's plan to free the slaves in August 76. It may be said that these people will want courage. Slaves generally are cowards, but set liberty before their eyes as the reward of their valor, and I believe we should find them sufficiently brave.
That's right. So obviously slaves are not going to risk their lives for their master's benefit, but if they could see there was a benefit for them, then Jonathan Dickinson Sargent, felt that they would show their bravery. But on the American side, I should say, what happened far too often was that, Virginia is a good example, the planters would often use a slave as a substitute for their sons. When their sons were drafted into the army, instead of the sons would go, they would send a slave, and the slave would come out, go back into slavery. Well, when the legislature finally got wind of this officially, this was prohibited. It was always thought that slaves could not serve in the army. When you served in the army, you were a free man. And the legislature made this mandatory. And so when a slave entered the army and then left after serving his time, whether that be 6 months or whether that be for 2 years or the duration, that individual was free.
Now, that in itself would be an inducement to sign up.
Oh, absolutely.
We'll find out how this opportunity slipped from the grasp of Americans, the opportunity to abolish slavery at the time of the American Revolution. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air. He has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian King of Great Britain, determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold. He has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or to restrain this execrable commerce, and that this assemblage of horrors might want no fact of distinguished die. He is now exciting those very people to rise in arms amongst us and to purchase that liberty of which he has deprived them, and murdering the people upon whom he also obtruded them, thus paying off former crimes committed against the liberties of one people with crimes which he urges them to commit against the lives of another. That's a passage intended by Thomas Jefferson to go into the Declaration of Independence, but deleted on June 28, 1776. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, John Kaminsky. We're looking at a lost opportunity to abolish slavery at the time of the American Revolution. In a sense, John, I can see why that might have been deleted. It's really a rather lawyeristic paragraph to absorb there. But clearly Jefferson was talking about the English perpetuating slavery, and not only that, but inciting slaves to rebel against their American masters.
That's right, and after all, the Declaration of Independence, one of the purposes was to explain to the countries of the world what we were doing and trying to get their assistance in obtaining our independence and in trading with us after we did get our independence. And so what Jefferson is saying in this clause is, yes, we have slaves amongst us, and it's primarily because the king has not allowed us to stop importing slaves into this country from Africa. And the reason he has prohibited that, the reason he has exercised his veto over colonial laws, is because the Royal African Company is making such huge profits from this. And so the Royal African Company is lobbying with the king to keep that despicable trade open. And Jefferson is trying to use this to explain why we in America do have slaves here. He's not going to say we're going to get rid of slaves. That will happen eventually if we allow it to die by not importing any more slaves. But unless we can prohibit the foreign slave trade, we'll never be able to get rid of slavery.
But once America was independent, didn't it take a compromise just to get the slave trade stopped in the United States?
Well, the slave trade is stopped at first in the Continental Association in 1774 as an economic warfare against Great Britain. And there is no law that's passed prohibiting the foreign slave trade. What happens is the individual states do pass measures. And in fact, 12 of the 13 states pass measures prohibiting the foreign slave trade. Only Georgia keeps it open because Georgia needs to replenish the slaves that it lost during the Revolution itself.
You would think that once you've acknowledged that the slave trade is wrong, that you would go ahead and just free slaves because one would follow from the other.
What you see happening is, starting with Pennsylvania, all the northern states pass what are called gradual emancipation laws. And what these laws provide is that from a certain date, any child born to a slave woman is going to be a free child. They'll stay with the mother until they reach adulthood. And during that time, they should be considered sort of as an indentured servant, and the master should be training that child for their eventual independence. And so in Pennsylvania, it's a wonderful preamble that precedes this, written by Thomas Paine, stating the iniquities of the institution of slavery. But they have to compromise by putting the adult age at 28. Now, the adult age in Pennsylvania is not 28. It's 21. But to give the masters an extra 7 years of service from their freed slaves, all the other northern states do the same thing, and they pass their gradual emancipation laws. The one passed by New York in 1785 is sort of interesting because it disenfranchises anybody that has any black blood in their background. And so freedmen before were enfranchised. They could vote. Now, with this new bill, they were not allowed to vote. And so what happened was that bill was vetoed by a council of revision. It's a combination of the governor and the judges that have a veto power, and they defeat the bill. It is overridden by the Senate by a two-thirds majority that's required, but the House of Representatives does not override it by the two-thirds majority necessary. And it takes then another 11 years before you get a gradual emancipation bill passed. And that's the last of the northern states that will pass this kind of measure to free the slaves. So you have Massachusetts, who's freed the slaves by judicial edict. Vermont, a new state coming on, not part of the Union yet, won't be part of the Union until 1791, but it is declared its independence from Great Britain and from New York at the same time, a new constitution prohibiting slavery. All the other northern states prohibit slavery by this gradual emancipation provision.
And where during this time do you find the discussion of the Three-Fifths Clause?
The Three-Fifths Clause is first brought up in Congress in 1783. There was a problem when the Articles of Confederation was drafted back in 1776 and 1777, how you allocate federal expenses, that is federal taxes. And they agreed that it would be done through land values. Well, the states were slow in getting their valuations of lands in, and they competed with each other to denigrate the value of their land, just as we might do today with our property taxes. No, our land is not worth as much as yours, because the more your land was worth, the more taxes you paid. And so it was not an efficient way to allocate federal expenses. And so they brought up an amendment to the Articles of Confederation. It would be proposed. And how do we do this? By population. Well, the next thing is, who do you consider in the population? Do you consider slaves in the population or not? And so the Southerners said slaves are not people, they're not human beings, they are property, and therefore they should not be considered in this. Well, the Northern delegates to Congress, they said slaves are people and they should be considered because that would shift the tax burden more to the South. Various compromises were put forth, and it was James Madison who put forth 60%. That is three-fifths, and that is what was adopted. 11 of the 13 states adopted that amendment. Only New Hampshire and Rhode Island did not. You needed unanimity to get an amendment passed. But because Congress had no other means of requisitioning the states, they used this method, and it became known as the federal ratio. And so that was in place at the time of the Constitutional Convention.
And then things seemed to get a little complicated, it seems to me, as if they weren't already complicated enough. Because by 1787, you're starting to add pretty good-sized chunks of territory to the fledgling country.
Yes. And in particular, the largest extent was the Northwest Territory, which was that land north and west of the Ohio River, which was originally part of Virginia. But Virginia realized that it was a danger to have such a large territory because you could not rule it effectively. You'd have to send an army. That army, like Julius Caesar, would come back and suppress liberty at home. So they ceded that territory to Congress. And it took Congress a while to pass various resolutions that would govern the territory. In July of 1787, they passed the Northwest Ordinance that called for the method of bringing that territory into the Union as states equal to the original 13 states. And it was difficult to get a quorum of Congress together. That was done by Charles Thompson, the Secretary of Congress, went to Philadelphia to the Constitutional Convention, got a few delegates that were also members of Congress, brought them back. There's a quorum there. And the author of the Northwest Ordinance, Nathan Dane from Massachusetts, he looked out over the audience there in Congress, and he saw that there were a majority of southern states represented. And so he deleted Article 6, which called for the prohibition of slavery or indentured servitude in the Northwest Territory. The southerners said, no, no, put it back in. William Grayson from Virginia explains in a letter that we did not want a competing plantation economy north of the Ohio River. And he said also there were political reasons. And I think those political reasons were at least two. One was they realized that New Englanders were settling in the Northwest Territory. They didn't have slaves. They were not bringing slaves with them. And so the settlers that were there wanted a free society, and they would not allow slavery to exist among them. The other was that by overtly prohibiting slavery from the Northwest Territory, they would then not have to say anything, be quiet, and slavery would be allowed in the Southwest Territory, that in what became Tennessee and Kentucky and eventually the northern parts of Alabama and Mississippi.
Which happened, well, fairly soon, statehood for Tennessee and Kentucky by 92 and 96.
That's
so
right.
Already implicitly slave states.
Yes, that's right.
Well, let's look at the wording of the Northwest Ordinance. There shall be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude in the said territory otherwise than in punishment of crimes whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, provided always that any person entering into the same from whom labor or service is lawfully claimed in any of the original states, such fugitive may be lawfully reclaimed and conveyed to the person claiming his or her labor or service as aforesaid. The fugitive idea, the idea that if a slave goes into one territory, has to be brought back, that's going to keep coming up in the 19th century as well.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, this is a key issue because, as you remember, I talked about the Quogue Walker case in Massachusetts where Chief Justice William Cushing prohibited slavery. And so Massachusetts was the land of opportunity for runaway slaves. If they could only get to Massachusetts, they would be freed and they wouldn't have to be returned. The Confederation government didn't have the authority to return slaves from Massachusetts. And so this was a very important provision in the Northwest Ordinance. You were not going to have that kind of freedom for runaways. They were going to have to be returned, even though you could not own slaves in that Northwest Territory.
So this Fugitive Slave Act actually does tumble through history and continue to create problems. By 1787, 1789, what else is going on in terms of constitutional thinking and slavery?
Well, I think the crucial issue now is Americans realize that the Articles of Confederation are deficient. By the mid-1780s, the economy has worsened and the world situation is such that America feels the lack of authority in a central government. They don't have coercive power to make their citizens behave properly, pay their federal taxes, and they don't have a navy. They sold their last naval vessel in 1786, and so they're vulnerable in the world, vulnerable to British restrictions against America in trade, vulnerable to the Barbary pirates in North Africa, Morocco, Algiers, Tunis, and Tripoli. The Moroccans declare war on America, capture a ship, a treaty is signed with them through the good auspices of the Spanish. But the Algerines, they capture two of our ships, and they're holding more than two dozen men in slavery. They're really at forced labor. These men are held hostage for over 10 years. It's not until the mid-1790s that they're free, and America has no ability to free them. And so both domestically and internationally, America needs a new government. And so you get a constitutional convention that's called. And in that constitutional convention, you have the initial division between large and small states. There are three large states. Virginia has 800,000 people. Massachusetts and Pennsylvania have 400,000. The other states are either middle or small states, relatively speaking. And they're concerned about how should they be represented in Congress under the Confederation. Congress, every state had one vote, that's all, only one vote. So you can see the difference between Virginia, which was gigantic at that time. Before 1783, Virginia was present-day Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and part of Minnesota, one vote. And tiny little Rhode Island, one vote. And so the large states wanted that changed. The small states wanted the protection of their integrity as a state so they wouldn't be run roughshod over.
Sounds like a bicameral arrangement to me.
That's right, and that's what happens. And so once that issue was settled, James Madison said every other issue was the division was over North and South, slave and free.
Mr. Madison contended that the states were divided into different interests not by their difference of size, but by other circumstances, the most material of which resulted partly from climate, but principally from the effects of their having or not having slaves. These two causes concurred in forming the great division of interests in the United States. It did not lie between the large and small states. It lay between the northern and southern. And if any defensive power were necessary, it ought to be mutually given to these two interests. He was so strongly impressed with this important truth that he had been casting about in his mind for some expedient that would answer the purpose. The one which had occurred was that instead of proportioning the votes of the states in both branches of Congress to their respective numbers of inhabitants, computing the slaves in the ratio of 5-3, they should be represented in one branch according to the number of free inhabitants only, and in the other according to the whole number, counting the slaves as if free. By this arrangement, the southern scale would have the advantage in one house and the northern in the other. He had been restrained from proposing this expedient by two considerations. One was his unwillingness to urge any diversity of interests on an occasion when it is but too apt to arise of itself. The other was the inequality of powers that must be vested in the two branches and which would destroy the equilibrium of interests.
So Madison thought that all the issues that were coming up had a north-south split to them. And I think he was correct in that. And so many of the compromises that came in that convention dealt with issues that divided the north and the south. The first would be on representation. And we talked about the Three-Fifths Clause as it reflected taxation under the Articles of Confederation. Now it was a little different thing. Instead of the stick of taxes, it was the carrot of representation. And so now they switch sides. The Southerners say, oh, yes, slaves are people, and they should be represented 100%. And the Northerners say, no, slaves are property. They should not be considered at all. And it didn't take very long before they went back to that federal ratio, as I said. It had been used by Congress to apportion taxes, and they adopted it then to apportion representation in the House of Representatives. But at the same time, they put that stick in there, that direct taxes would be apportioned also on the basis of population, counting three-fifths of the slaves. This, I think the important thing for us to remember at this time is that this is not talking about an individual human being is three-fifths of a person. No, it's the total population of slaves in a state that is to be considered for representation or taxation purposes. There were two other compromises that were very important. One was the foreign slave trade. And we talked about that before, how Jefferson wanted to stop that in the Declaration of Independence. And again, it was a compromise here. They decide that Congress will be allowed to prohibit the foreign slave trade in 1808. So for 20 years, it's going to be open. This was done at the demand, really, of Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina. They said that they would not ratify this Constitution if the foreign slave trade was prohibited immediately. Everyone realized that 20 years hence, the dominance of the North in Congress would mean that Congress would, in fact, prohibit the foreign slave trade.
Well, were they interested in these southern states in what when it came to extending the slave trade? I mean, was there no longer a surplus for most of the South?
No. And remember I mentioned Lackland McIntosh and how he passed around petitions demanding the immediate emancipation of the slaves. In 1787, December of 1787, McIntosh runs for the Georgia Ratifying Convention. He's defeated. He writes a letter to a friend, John Wiret, who is elected to the convention and will become president of the convention. And McIntosh says he has some anti-federalist leanings. The anti-federalist writers are somewhat convincing him that the Constitution is dangerous. And so what he proposes to Wiret is that Georgia ratify for 20 years. And that will then allow Georgia, in 1808, when Congress would prohibit the slave trade, would allow Georgia to reassess its positions. He says, we need slaves. And so McIntosh has come 180 degrees from where he was before, advocating the immediate emancipation. Now, keep the slave trade open. Maybe we'll give up union in favor of keeping the slave trade open for us. And the entire country pretty much had done that turnabout just as McIntosh did.
And it's not very inspiring. We're going to look at some of the great figures in American history like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison in terms of what might they have done differently when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I will not enter on the right which man has to enslave his brother man, nor upon the moral and political effects of slavery on individuals or on society, because these things are better understood by you than by me. My object is to entreat and beseech you to exert your knowledge and influence in devising and getting into operation some plan for the gradual emancipation of slavery. That's Edward Coles writing to Thomas Jefferson, July 31st, 1814. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is John Kaminsky, author of, among other books, A Necessary Evil, Slavery and the Debate Over the Constitution. It's so uninspiring sometimes. I mean, it's, you know, where you're looking at all these arguments about counting or not counting slaves and so on. It's so uninspiring to find our major figures in American history not taking a more active stand at this point in terms of freeing slavery. What can you say about, you know, let's start with George Washington, the founder of his country. What might he have done?
Well, I think what you find that there are Americans that are taking stands all over the country, particularly in the North, they're taking stands. We mentioned the gradual emancipation laws. But in the South, there are individuals that are freeing their slaves. So it's not as if this is an impossibility. People are doing it for various reasons, mainly for the moral reason, sometimes fear of God. Warner Lewis owned 300 slaves, and they had a torrential thunderstorm occurring one evening. And you know how it is when you're sick. You pray to God, get me through this, and I'll be a better person. Well, that's what Warner Lewis said in praying to God, get me through this evening, and I'll free my slaves. And he did. And he was ridiculed for that by his contemporaries. But it's my interpretation that the only way that we could have gotten rid of slavery at this time is if the Southern leadership, men like Washington, Jefferson, and Madison, stood up and, by example, freed their slaves. Lafayette suggested such a thing to Washington in 1784. Let's buy a plantation in the west of Virginia, stock it with freedmen, and that will show that they can survive on their own. They won't be wards of the state, and it will show that you favor emancipation. It never came about. Lafayette did such a thing in the West Indies. Benjamin Rush did such a thing, set up an experiment in northern Pennsylvania. And so it was being done. Washington, when he was approached by the Methodist ministers to sign a petition to emancipate slaves, would not do it. Washington realized after the Revolution what a terrible thing slavery was. And he felt that he would not buy any more slaves if he could avoid it, and he would not sell slaves, would not break up families. He felt that would be a terrible thing. He wrote a memo to himself in which he said he was training the children. It was too late for some of the older folks, but he was training the children for their freedom, and he hoped that his maker would understand. He was afraid to come out and take a position because he said that he really favored the northern position of emancipation, but that if he did that, he felt the whole South would break away. And so he was reluctant to make a public statement. When he died, he anticipated his death before Martha, his wife, and he understood that many of the slaves that he possessed were not really his. They were the dowager. Martha had brought these from her previous marriage, and so he could not free them. But his slaves and Martha's slaves had intermarried. It would be a terrible thing if a husband was freed and a wife would stay in bondage, or the opposite way around. And so what he provided was only Will would be free, Will Smith, who was his trusted aide throughout the war, and in fact had broken his kneecap while surveying with Washington in 1786. So he had rheumatism and had this knee problem, couldn't get around. Will was free if he wanted to be free. Didn't have to be free if he didn't want to be free. He was given a pension. He could stay on the plantation or leave. That was the only slave Washington freed. The rest would be freed when Martha died. Now, it didn't take the slaves very long to realize that their freedom was dependent upon Martha's death. And it didn't take Martha long before she realized they knew this. And so she freed all the slaves in 1801. And they were given pensions to help them purchase land and survive. And the last pensions were paid into the 1840s. The estate paid pensions to these individuals. But that's how Washington freed his slaves. Jefferson and Madison were not in as favorable a financial situation. Jefferson also was always afraid of conflict. And when asked by Everett Coles, who is his neighbor, his brother, Isaac Coles, was Jefferson's secretary when Jefferson was president. Edward Coles is Madison's secretary at this time. And Edward Coles has inherited slaves. And he says, I will not stay in Virginia with slaves. And Jefferson encourages him to stay. Don't go away and leave your slaves here. And Coles says, I'm not intending to leave my slaves here. I'm taking them with me. And he took them with him to Illinois on flat-bottom boats. And when they arrived in Illinois, he freed his slaves and gave them money to help buy land. Jefferson would not come out and support a statement, even a statement that would be used after his death, favoring emancipation. Both Jefferson and Madison favored a tripart plan in getting rid of slavery. First of all, a gradual and compensated emancipation. The legislature would have to compensate slave owners. Second, the colonization of freedmen, that freedmen, freed blacks, could never live in a society with whites. They would hate the whites for what they had done, and the whites would forever have a prejudice against blacks. And third, you have to have a replacement for them to go out in the fields and work. Right. Jefferson wasn't going to do that himself. And so they favored having immigration of Protestant Germans, those kind of people who had settled in Pennsylvania, bring them in masse to take the place of the slaves that were going to be forced to go back either to Africa or to the West or to the West Indies.
Of course, you'd have to pay these Germans.
Well, you would encourage them, giving them land, the various mechanisms used throughout colonial American history to encourage colonization.
What would you say is the thing that strikes you most, looking at all these documents from the American Revolution and shortly thereafter about slavery and what was not done?
Well, I would say there was this very, very small window of opportunity, only maybe about 4 or 5 years. And we had the means. We had the Northwest Territory public land that could have been sold. Unfortunately, that the proceeds of that land would have had to come at the expense of the Indians living in that territory. They would be pushed out or eradicated. And so that would have been a terrible thing as well. But we had this system of slavery that everyone pretty much at that time felt was indefensible. Only at the very end of this period do you have the positive good argument of slavery coming out. But most Americans understood that it was a dreadful thing that we had. And I think they all agreed with George Mason in a speech that he gave in the Constitutional Convention, in which he said, nations do not get punished in the hereafter. God will not punish us later on, as as a nation. You can punish individuals in the hereafter, but not nations. As a nation, we will suffer here in this world with civil war. And obviously, his premonition came true.
We've been looking at a lost opportunity to abolish slavery at the time of the American Revolution. John Kaminsky, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, hoping that you'll join Emily Auerbach and me for the next hour of University of the Air. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for University of the Air as our guest tells us about plastic surgery, both the kind that you choose and the kind that is less elective. How far can it go to change you? Next Sunday afternoon at 4 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.